Down south, they say it's the economy, stupid. Up here, we say it's the economy, eh? And this is Political Economy Radio, a progressive take on economic issues in Canada and beyond. My name is Michał Rozwodski, and welcome to the show.
Today, I'm happy to present the recording of a recent forum on Thomas Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century that took place in Vancouver. The event drew a standing room only crowd of over 150, and the spirited discussion that followed showed the appetite that exists to talk about inequality, capitalism, and the future of our socioeconomic arrangements. The event featured four local speakers and was co-sponsored by the Progressive Economics Forum, Ricochet Media, the SFU Institute for the Humanities, and the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. Thanks also to my colleagues at Red Eye Radio for making this recording available. I'll introduce the first two speakers now, and the last two at a break. The first speaker is Iglika Ivanova, economist and public interest researcher at the CCPA's BC office. She focused on Piketty's inequality data. The second speaker is yours truly. My focus was Piketty's theoretical framework.
Excellent. Thank you very much for this introduction. Thanks everyone for coming. It's so amazing to see so many people on such a beautiful sunny evening who have come to learn more about this book and why it matters. And I think it's a testament to the book, but also to the issues that the book addresses, because there is something going on here with inequality of both income and wealth that people see that is not invisible and that really needs to be addressed. And I think this is one of the contributions of the book of kickstarting this conversation even in more mainstream economics venues. So what I'm going to start today, the evening with, is sort of the trends and consequences of inequality. So what's been happening to inequality and why are we all here? Basically, we're all here because of this. Because of this chart that we actually owe to Piketty's work with some of his colleagues, which is looking at income tax data from 1913, when income tax was first introduced in the United States, and looking at what's been happening to the share of total income in the US going to the top 1%. And what we see is quite remarkable, and it's been referred to as the U-shape. We see that inequality declined after the two world wars, but then since the early 80s, it started to increase again. And this is very important contribution of Piketty's work, the fact that we can look at this for a century, basically, since 1913, because if you look at the more traditional sources of income data that we have in Canada, for example, the surveys all start in the 1970s. The Canadian Main Survey of Labor and Income Dynamics, started in 1976. So that's just at the start when inequality starts increasing. And if you see this data, you could conclude that inequality has always been increasing. But in fact, having an opportunity to look at the whole 100 years worth of data, we can see that the rich haven't always gotten richer. And that's important. It's encouraging to think that this isn't something that's a trend that has always been this way. And it's important to recognize. The other thing that this graph shows us is basically that nothing changed after the recession. You can see a little blip down at the end there around 2008, but the income of the top 1% shot back up right after that. So we're not really seeing a big change in what's happening since the recession, and that's why Piketty's book is important. So here, he's put a lot of work into compiling top income stats for a whole bunch of countries. You see the ones that are covered currently, and it's all accessible for free on the internet. So I suggest you check it out if you're interested to see if your country is covered. Now, a lot of people commenting on inequality have been saying it's mostly a US problem, and Canada doesn't really have anything to worry about. But this chart really shows that that's not quite the case. Sure, we're showing up a little bit less than equal these days than the United States, but don't get too self-congratulatory. In fact, just last week, a new paper came out from a number of economists, well, an economist, a statistician, and a law professor, that suggests that that these kind of graphs seriously underestimate the amount of income earned by the Canadians because of what is known as Canadian-controlled private corporation or privately held Canadian companies, which are a huge source of income for the Canadian 1% and are not counted in the income tax data. But a similar corporation vehicle in the United States is counted in the U.S. data. So when you account for the discrepancy, you actually get something that looks quite a bit closer to the U.S. picture. So no reason for Canada to get complacent. That's the bad news. Now, what are the facts? Whoops. Sorry. What are the facts about income inequality in Canada? Well, it's been on the rise since the 1980s, but especially since the mid-90s. And there's different ways to measure it, but basically all of them show that the gains from growth have been going disproportionately to the very top of the income distribution. And that's something that we should worry about. So Canadians in the poor income group have become slightly less poor, but as you see there in the stats, they gained about $2,000 in 35 years, so really that's nothing to be proud of. We're less unequal than the United States, but that's hardly a consolation. We're one of the most unequal countries in the world. So what this does is raise the question of who does the economic system work for? And this is a question. This is a graph from a paper my colleague from the National Office of the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives produced. And it basically shows that incomes at the very top have been growing rapidly since the 1970s, but average incomes in Canada have barely moved. And this is a big problem. And it's been confirmed by a recent study by the OECD, which shows that about 37%, so more than one-third of all the gains from growth in Canada since the 1970s have gone to the top 1%. So the top 1% are 37% of all growth. So this is problematic. Why? Well, first of all, inequality creates big problems with social injustice. It is unjust to be living in poverty in a country that is so wealthy. And that itself is a reason to fight it. But it's also bad for a whole set of other things. And there's a growing body of research that shows all of this. And I wanted to let you know that there's a lot of research recently, including from unusual suspects like the International Monetary Fund or the Conference Board of Canada, that shows very clearly that inequality is also bad for growth. It's connected to more volatility in the economy, to shorter periods of economic growth, and it's just not conducive to the economy thriving. So it's not just bad for people, it's bad for the economy. It exacerbates many social problems. It's bad for the environment because it erodes this notion of trust that we're all in this together and the ability to take action collectively on big global problems. And it threatens democracy, and that's one of the reasons that Piketty is particularly concerned about, and this is a quote from his book, he's seriously concerned about our drift towards oligarchy. He says that the nature of capitalism is such that this is what you can expect to happen. Now, how is inequality justified? You know, why do we put up with this, right? And we put up with this because we're told quite a lot that inequality is the result of individual choices, that we live in a meritocracy, and if you're doing poorly, it's because you're not working hard enough. Or that inequality is necessary in order to, you know, as Kevin O'Leary suggested, encourage people to pull themselves by their bootstraps. However, the final kind of argument that's being brought up is this idea that you shouldn't worry too much about it because inequality will eventually stabilize and stop being a problem. And this is taught in intro economics classes as the Kuznets curve, you know, the idea that, and it is really that poorly defined and vague, that at a certain, when the economy is in an early stage of industrialization, inequality will grow, but at some mature stage of capitalism or industrialization, it'll start going down again. Don't worry about it. And the reason why they came up with this is actually they had access to the same kind of income tax data that Piketty looked, but this guy worked in the 50s, so all he saw was the decline in inequality that happened after the wars. So he knew inequality had increased in the 19th century, he saw it declining after the wars, and there you go, he developed this graph and decided that it's a universal law. Yeah. Turns out one of the main contributions of Piketty's work is that he produces a lot of evidence that shows this is not the case. He also challenges the very core of the moral legitimacy of capitalism, the idea that it's a meritocracy, and really put a big hole in that illusion. He talks about education not being meritocratic in the States. and the rise of wealth, the fact that in an economy where the return to wealth exceeds the rate of growth, then inherited wealth becomes more and more important and shows quite clearly using actual data that a large, more than half of wealth in both Europe and America is inherited. So all this idea of self-made billionaires is not true. In fact, close to 2/3 of wealth is inherited currently, and it's going on an upward trend. So he really, he doesn't tackle inequality because of all the social and economic problems with it. He tackles it based on the idea that it is unjust and it is unnecessary for capitalism. He explains that there is no reason to tolerate such high levels of inequality. They don't actually stimulate productive behavior. It stimulates people engaging in all sorts of behavior, trying to protect their privilege and entrench their privilege. And as a result, it actually is bad instead of being good. So here are some charts I took from his book. They're all available online. So this is one of the arguments he makes, is that we're seeing a return of wealth in Europe. And there's a lot more data, like a lot older data. You see here that the chart started 1870, so that's quite a long time ago in Europe. But basically, wealth was very large relative to the annual growth of the economy. And what this means is that even if you're a self-made entrepreneur, you can only earn that much every year. You will never catch up to the people who have huge amounts of wealth, so they will always be ahead. That's why inheritance is more important in those societies. Then in the 20th century, we see wealth decreases in importance relative to economic growth, but what we're seeing again is the same U-shape, going right back up. And he projects that at this rate, in 15 years, about 90% of wealth in France will be inherited. So 90% of all existing wealth will be inherited. And that's a huge problem, thank you. Wealth is growing in importance in the U.S. as well. Sorry, where is my... Although in the U.S., partly because of the way the country was settled, people didn't come with large holdings of wealth, so wealth was never that big of a deal in the U.S. as it was in Europe. But as we see, it's kind of becoming to... it's reaching European levels, so to speak, and it's going on a trend up. So wealth is distributed very unequally, and I wanted to put this up even though it has lots of numbers, but the idea is people underestimate actually how unequally wealth is distributed, but about 90% of total wealth in the States is owned by the top 20%, right? And most people will not be able to tell you this. So one of the things that Piketty tells us, though, is that, and it's illustrated by this graph, is that until the mid-20th century, the United States was a land of opportunity. It was more equal, and wealth was less important than it was in Europe. But since the 50s, things have changed, and now the United States actually has higher levels of wealth inequality than Europe. But they're both kind of on their way up. And that's based on official administrative statistics, which are based on surveys asking people to report how much they own. But the real data has to come from things like the Forbes 400 or the Canadian version of the wealthiest Canadians, because we actually don't cover those people very well. So even the stats that he shows are likely to be an underestimate. In the meantime, for the rest of us, this is median earnings for full-time, full-year workers in British Columbia. Yeah, they kind of haven't moved at all. In fact, have declined slightly since 1976. And you see, unfortunately, the data set starts in 1976, so I can't show you any longer. And so that's part of the problem, why inequality is a big problem, because while wealth is growing on one hand and income's growing at the top, this is what's happening in the middle. And this hides other inequalities. So here we have male and women full-time, full-year earnings, and the gap is quite large. It's $12,000 currently, or a quarter of the women's earnings. So if I could show you Aboriginal people or people with disabilities or visible minorities, it would look similar, but unfortunately, data is not easily available from Statistics Canada. So what all this means is that we've seen huge imbalances in how growth is affecting incomes. So this is what's happened to median incomes at the top, at the middle, at the bottom 90%, and for full-time, full-year earnings. And you don't need to be able to say which line is which, because the whole point is to see that the only one group that is benefiting from growth is basically the top 1% in Canada. And is that because income or GDP didn't increase? Oh, by the way, this is all adjusted for inflation, right? So this shows real growth. So what do you think happened to GDP? Here is your GDP per capita. So GDP per capita increased by about 40% over that period. And yet, full-time, full-year workers are earning the same, essentially, as they were in 1970s, or their parents were in 1970s. And their incomes are growing at much lower rates than the growth of the economy, while the income at the top is growing at a much higher rate than the growth of the economy. So who does the economy work for? And so here's my summary so far, so I can fit in my 15 minutes. Piketty's book shows a large body of evidence. I just gave you a little taste of the different graphs you can find. There's a lot of charts, and I love that, and probably do too. If you are here on the sunny evening, you must love charts. But Piketty compiles, one of the contributions he makes is that he just puts together this wealth of evidence that goes over really long periods of time historically and allows us to see what's happening. And he argues, and then he builds a theory that Michal is going to talk about, where he argues that what's been happening since the 80s is not an aberration, it's capitalism functioning normally. And without any changes, you can expect more of the same, because the market has no automatic mechanism, unlike the Kuznets curve, you know, suggested. There is no automatic mechanism to reduce inequality. So if you need something to change, you have to make something change. That's me. Thank you.
Ilik has shown you all the charts and the graphs. I guess the guiding question of my presentation is, where's the theory, or what is the theory behind these charts, or are these just charts sort of looking for a theory, which some people have talked about? You thought I'd give you the answer right away. No, it's 600 pages on the 601 you get, you find out. So I just wanted to go back to this. I want to talk very briefly about three things. First, what is capital, how Piketty defines capital, and how this might differ from other definitions very quickly. How it accumulates, so what is this sort of theory that's driving all the evidence that Ilik presented and that's presented in the book. And then talk a little bit about Piketty's place within economics and how his ideas might differ from mainstream neoclassical economics and where they might overlap, and to see what kind of where the break is and how much of a break this is, how much space there is for different analysis. So now you get to find out. So Piketty has a very, very broad definition of capital. He calls it basically anything that can be traded on some market, the sum of non-financial and financial assets, houses, land, factories, inventory, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, the whole shebang. And this differs somewhat from two sort of other extremes that you could take, or two other definitions. A lot of mainstream economic theory, and a lot of when often we think of capital, we think of productive capacity. So not all the rest of this stuff, not all the stocks, not all the bonds, but just, you know, factories, tools, office buildings, and all of that. So a sort of quantitative difference from mainstream economics, which we'll see it as a lot narrower. The other end is a view of capital as something that's not really even about things, but much broader. That's something like a social force or a social relation. This, of course, Marx and all sort of Marxian economics sees this, and this is a bit more of a qualitative difference of looking at capital, not really, regardless if it's a bigger or smaller mass of things. Marxian economics will say that there's actually, this represents a mass of social relations and relationships between people rather than just a bunch of hammers and what have you. A second very quick definition
that I think is kind of interesting that Piketty gives a little later on, is he says capital fulfills two basic functions. So it's a factor of production and housing. So he actually puts housing as a central form of capital and a central way of thinking about capital, which I think is quite different than a lot of people think about it. And he says he basically bases this on history, saying that, you know, we used to have, you know, the axe with the rock on it, and a cave, and that's where capital comes from. So it's historically earliest forms of capital accumulation involve both tools and implements and improvements to land and rudimentary dwellings, and we now have much improved caves and axes. So it's sort of anthropological root for this sort of really all-encompassing definition of capital. And these two functions that we'll have, so it's a means of production and also a store of value. So a lot of capital goods are quite durable, so you can, you know, park them somewhere and they'll just sort of keep value for you. So now we can turn to this question of how it is that we get capital accumulation, that we get all this data about inequality rising and capital accumulating in fewer hands. Basically, in many ways, Piketty's presenting a lot of stylized facts that are sort of overlaid with a theory. There's three fundamental laws, though, as we'll see, they're not really quite all laws, not what most people would think of as laws really, and they're based on empirical data. So it's sort of empirical data that's then overlaid with some equations. And a lot of values for things are taken to be sort of long-run tendencies. So rather than looking for a savings rate in a theory and how it functions, Piketty says, throughout history in most societies, we've seen the savings rate vary around a range around 10% or so. I mean, due to bigger or smaller shocks to the economy, it'll vary a bit, but there's sort of a long-run tendency. Same thing with the return on capital. I'll show a chart, you know, even back to prehistory, and he says this has been really quite stable. Same thing with the rate of growth, other than the catastrophic wars of the 20th century. And Iglika said it's nice and encouraging that inequality can go down. Notably, inequality went down starting in 1913, and we know what was happening in Europe then. So a lot of destruction that caused this, and that's part of, I think, what you were saying too, right? There's no sort of natural tendency for this to happen within capitalism. So the rebuilding, we saw growth rates that are quite higher, but throughout history, he says growth rates have also been quite stable, accounting for population growth on the range of 1% to 2%. And what's varied widely is this capital income ratio, which is some of the last graphs Iglika showed, which has gone from under capitalism from roughly to the 700%, and varied a bit more. So the laws. I won't bore you with the math, but I'll just leave the laws up there. The first law, as many people have pointed out, not really a law, it's just sort of a definition that relates the income share that goes to capital to the rate of return and basically the amount of capital, or at least the relative amount. Why does this matter? I think that's an important question. I think the way Piketty puts this, where he makes sort of the independent variable here, the capital income ratio, it's undermining the sort of mainstream stylized fact that we actually have a relatively stable capital income share. A relatively stable part of income that's going to capital. And Piketty says that this can actually vary quite widely because the capital income ratio varies. So the more or less capital there is relative to how much income there is, we can see more of the proceeds of what we're making going to owners of capital. And again, it's might seem sort of obvious, but this has been one of the main stylized facts sort of mainstream growth theory has been that this share is relatively stable and it comes out of the production function. So capital can take a greater or smaller cut. His second law is basically a long-term tendency. So it's not true at every point, but it's true sort of in the long run. And this one relates, again, the amount of capital to the savings rate and the growth rate. And why this one matters for our purposes today, I think, is it describes how capital can accumulate when growth, basically when growth levels sink back to their long-run trends, which is what Piketty thinks will happen. So again, looking at the 20th century more as an aberration, and once G falls, you'll see the amount of capital in the economy going up, and because it's concentrated in few hands, it'll remain there. And again, post-war reconstruction, and he thinks, you know, we might have a little bit of higher growth left because of the global south catching up sort of to the technological frontier, but once that's done, we're back to very low levels of growth. And the last sort of most famous, again, law, which has come out of this book, is this R is greater than G, which again is not so much a law as, you know, basically an observed inequality through human history that Piketty thinks has been the case. And this, again, is a major vehicle towards greater wealth concentration. Because if people who are, if the owners of capital are able to, if the economy is growing relatively slowly, but the returns to capital are growing relatively quickly and the mass of capital is rising, the people who already own the capital will be getting more and more of the proceeds of what's going, of the income that's being generated. And this, he has this nice phrase here where this R is greater than G is a way that the past devours the future. So here's going back to the year, you know, Iglika showed some data going back to 1870. This is going back to the year zero. potentially a bit more speculative, but this is what Piketty's, but this is what he's basing, right, R is greater than G on. It's, you know, it's a law in the sense that this is how he thinks the world has looked. And again, we see the 20th century as a sort of aberration where the rate of growth of output has actually been higher than the rate of return on capital. Going really speculative, going from zero to 2,200, looking into the crystal ball. I mean, I think this just really shows, you know, what he thinks and what we've seen in the 20th century as being really something that's quite different. And this is a recounting of the things I already said. You know, there's basically wealth concentrates because of these mechanisms, because the rate of return is greater than the rate of growth, and it concentrates increasingly in the hands of the rich because the rich save more than other people. That's the first graph. And they're able to actually extract a greater rate of return, usually, than the rest of us through, you know, just better access, better financial managers, being able to basically pay to be able to get the best returns. So he says, you know, globalized, the only place where financial markets really enter into the analysis in a meaningful way is, in one of the ways is showing how capital is able to sort of engineer financial markets to increase its bargaining power. And the last point, capital will concentrate because people, again, another sort of, you know, the fact that he's taking from human nature is people just sort of see inheritance as a good thing. So they're not saving so they can, you know, go on lots of vacations during retirement. They're saving so that they can leave large bequests to their kids just because that's how, you know, because this is a sort of an anthropological fact of some sort. This is actually a recounting of Iglika. So this is what Kuznets saw, and this allowed us to get this really optimistic sort of bell curve graph. And then if we uncover, Piketty gets pretty much the exact opposite from the same data, just going further into the future. So I have a few more things, but I'm running out of time. So this brings me to the very last point. And showing, you know, so we've had this sort of, yeah, so we had the optimistic picture from people like Kuznets and from mainstream economics. Piketty's showing us a pretty pessimistic picture. But where, other than this, you know, other than this change from optimism to pessimism, where's the difference? So Piketty in many ways inherits a framework from mainstream economics. So there's still a lot of focus on long-run tendencies towards equilibrium. You know, there will be a lot of wealth concentration, but we'll get to a certain point, and the economy naturally moves towards these sort of centers of attraction. Growth is driven by population and technology changes. And there's not really much, even though he does talk about finance as part of capital, there's not really much of a role for it in his theory. It's really a real economy story where financial stabilities and crises just aren't really given much attention. Where he differs from the mainstream is both in his style. So, I mean, if you pick up any sort of mainstream economic paper, it'll be 75% math, whereas, you know, and the math will not look like two letters and and a symbol. So, you know, simple math in the literary style, so something that's going back to sort of, you know, Marx or Smith or people like that who didn't really have a lot of math and have definitely a much more literary style. And the content. There's a much bigger focus on history. There's a much bigger focus on social conflict over distribution. And the focus over these forces of, you know, this is not the happy story of Kuznets. This is a story of divergence and of increasing inequality. Skip that. I'll leave this as a last slide. Because what I think ultimately is we have a lot of data. We have a sort of rudimentary theory, and we still in many ways have with Piketty, as I mentioned, you know, from neoclassical economics, still a bit of that framework, a sort of, you know, equilibrium framework, a balanced growth path framework. And I think there's a lot of room to take some of these things that Piketty started to point out and sort of run with them and look more at power, at politics, at production, which Piketty doesn't look at, and look at where these sort of sociological observations that he's making are coming from. What's the nitty gritty of the theory, and you know, if we really want to have a politics coming out of this, you know, where are these super managers coming from? He mentions the rise of a patrimonial middle class. So over the second half of the 20th century, a section of the working class has gotten access to wealth. People have houses. We see this in Vancouver particularly. There's a section of, you know, people who are regular folks who are sitting on million-dollar houses, and their political values are changed because of that, right? This is not the world of Marx. So how does this affect our politics and you know, how does this affect the utopian project that he presents as well? Great. Thank you.
The third speaker of the night was Marjorie Griffin Cohen, professor of political science at Simon Fraser University. She explained and critiqued Piketty's proposed solutions to runaway inequality. The final speaker was Jeff Mann, professor of geography, also at SFU. His wide-ranging talk capped off the night with some thoughts on Piketty, liberalism, and fear.
Thanks, everybody, for coming out tonight. I wonder how many here have actually read this book.
Good question. Ben?
Yeah, some people have. It's
all
quite
of it.
It's quite daunting. And does anybody know how to pronounce his name? Anyway, according to the New York Times, it's Piketty. Anyway, that's what I'm saying, according to the New York Times, who gives instructions. I want to talk about Piketty's solutions and the lessons for us, particularly since we generally have an idea of what we think is useful around public policy in order to reduce inequalities. But first of all, I want to say how important I think Piketty's work is. I think it's because it puts distribution inequality at the center of economic analysis in the way it hasn't been for a long time. And also, usually we just look at wealth, at income. We don't know much about wealth. And so this is the first time we're really having some good information on it and some good discussion on it. So what he does is also, when he looks at income, he looks at
the concentration within the whole income category, which we often don't do as well, not very much. Sometimes we do between males and females or between different races, but we don't look at that whole income. And he does, of course, the same for wealth, which we're more familiar with. But I think he also reminds us of the deeply political nature of economics. And he calls himself a political economist and stresses that there isn't an economic determination per se, but that it really does matter what the public policy is. And it was because of policies that you did have a reduction of concentration of wealth and income in the middle part of the 20th century, and their increase in public ownership, increase in minimum wages, various kinds of policies like this. So his main point is that a country that saves a lot and grows very slowly, as happens in big countries like ours, and particularly the United States, will over a long period of time, a very long period of time, will accumulate massive amounts of capital stock relative to the income. And this will affect the social structure and distribution of wealth. It'll have a profound effect on the social structure and distribution of wealth. And this is what's happening in developing nations now. And what he anticipates is that we are going to have a more and more and more unequal society because of the accumulation of private wealth. So what he sees is what he refers to as a hyper-patrimonial society, where this is what we've talked about, where inheritance becomes very, very important. But he does see in places like North America in particular, the hyper-meritocratic society, where you have this superstars which have these vast amounts of money, like we saw today, the head of Nissan gets $10 million a year. You know, these huge, huge amounts of money. So he refers this as hand in the till versus the invisible hand. So you have a... so what he sees is an illegalitarian spiral happening. And what he says already in the U.S. is more unequal than any other society in history has been. And that's from his long-term data, which is quite fascinating. But I want to look at what he sees as solutions to the problems and how that fits into our notions of what is important for people who are progressive and on the left in Canada. So the reduced inequalities that happened in the 20th century, he attributes primarily to dealing with wars and the Great Depression. And he really doesn't talk about agency here. He just says these were the sort of impetus for this all to happen. You had a huge destruction of capital. You needed to pay down an enormous debt as a result of the wars. At this time, you had even the people on the right doing this because you had such an enormous debt. So they were in favor of progressive taxation. They were in favor of nationalization. You had rent control, minimum wages that were indexed. So then you had very, very high upper level capital taxes too. So highly progressive income taxes taxes on inheritance and income. So what does he see as solutions to the problems that are going on? Now some of this sounds a little lame. You will see if you read it. Like, for example, no, he does. He says, knowledge and skill diffusion is the greatest thing you can do in order to reduce income inequality. Yeah. So education and technology are a great leveler. I won't go into this, but that's not a very powerful tool because that's been around a while and we have seen that that's important, but we see how that's been undermined, of course. And basically, he doesn't really see social mobility having occurred through education very much, at least not in this century. He sees it pretty much static. So there's a slight contradiction there. But what he sees as the most important thing, and which is really a new focus, is a progressive global capital tax. That's what he would like to see. And it's not just a tax on real estate, which is about all we really tax now in a very serious way, but a tax on absolutely everything. And as a result of this, he favors this tax on capital, which would really require Well, you could have a government like the United States, which is really powerful and really strong, institute this, but most governments aren't powerful enough to do it. So basically, he's talks a lot about Europe becoming more of a government so that they could control capital better and then tax it. But basically, he's not talking about distribution between countries. He's talking about getting enough within a particular country. Now, he talks also about a confiscatory tax on the very, very top, the kind of thing that you had, and he gives charts on this, that he had during the, really during the period of the Second World War. And the idea of these kind of taxes is not to raise money, because he said basically any tax you want to do to discourage people from doing something isn't going to raise money. It's going to discourage them from doing the action, and that's the whole point of it. And that's a very, you know, you might raise some money initially, but basically that isn't what you're going to be raising money for. So it's not important for revenue generating, at least not the confiscatory kind of tax, but he still thinks you need to do this at the very, very high incomes. Because what he said happened is when countries like the United States and Britain reduce their very, very high marginal rates, tax rates on income, when they reduce them in the 70s, up to the 70s, that was the time when the CEOs and the managers of the rich, rich companies decided, hey, we can gain now. We couldn't gain before. There was no point in trying to have huge super salaries. So now you have the super salaries. And he said, in countries like ours, this is what is causing the greatest inequality now, is the super salaries. And that's what's taking, they move from being wage earners to becoming, having salaries to having enormous wealth as a result of this. Of course, what he's suggesting on as a capital tax is not a very big tax, but he says because there's so many of these very wealthy people, it actually would generate a fair amount of money. But he's saying no tax on anything, any wealth less than 1 million euros, a 1% tax on, it's graduated up to a 2% over 5 million euros. Not a huge, huge tax. But nevertheless, he does think that coupled with an income tax that was confiscatory at the very top would actually eliminate this kind of extraordinary hyper-meritocratic society which is happening now. So the other thing that he talks about constantly are high growth rates. He sees high growth rates as essential because they contribute to the reduction in inequality. It's the low growth regimes which are anticipated in the future in developed countries, and this is what's going to cause problems. So he is in favor of that. There are other kind of possibilities he talks about to reduce this. How much time do I have? The debt. The other kind of taxes he gets, he's not somebody who says tax, any tax is a good tax, you know, because then we can put it to work. That's not what he's saying. And he certainly is not in favor of sales taxes. He's basically against sales tax, and he's against any kind of flat taxes for services that we tend to have in Canada for things like healthcare, pensions, that kind of thing. He sees them as very contributing to the inegalitarian society. So he takes things a little bit different from what we are used to doing. He said inflation can sometimes work around controlling the debt. By the way, he's against a debt too. He thinks this is very problematic. He said taxes are a much better way to finance government than a debt, and the debt really does. You're borrowing from rich people and paying them back at higher rates. And so what he would like to see is a 15% flat tax right off the bat on the highest income earners just for one shot deal, just to reduce all debts, and then just basically start out all over again. So he favors a profit tax directly on corporations as well. We always hear our corporate taxes have decreased and decreased and decreased, as we know, in Canada. And the argument is always, well, it's double taxation because people get income from corporations and then they're taxed again. And he says that doesn't really work that way. The people get the incomes, they're able to evade them paying taxes on it. It would be better if you did it right at the source of the whole thing. He's also in favor of globalization and free trade. He thinks globalization is Free trade and economic openness are ultimately in everyone's interests, and he is against protectionism. And he does not seem to see that things like free trade and financial services is problematic at all. But if we look at WikiLeaks, yesterday I think it was, or the day before, the trade and services agreement has a financial annex, which is basically to reduce all kinds of control over capital, over financial capital internationally. I mean, this is quite an extraordinary thing, but this seems to be the kind of thing that I think Piketty hasn't quite thought through there, because this is problematic. There are other things he says about the distribution of wealth that we usually look at, like the age distribution, that we see that we have, that there's a class, there's no longer a class war, there's an age war, and he said, no, this is contrary to widespread belief. Intergenerational warfare has not been replaced class warfare. Basically, he says there's enormous amounts of wealth. It's just government's unwillingness to tax private wealth that allows these kinds of things to be occurring. There's very little on gender and race. He does talk in one place about how societies that have smaller wage gaps between males and females have also less concentration of wealth. He talks about this. But basically, Piketty is quite weak about the distribution of income between nations. And what he doesn't examine, there are quite a few things he doesn't look at. What I think is quite significant is he does not look at the 50% below at all. So we do not look at what has been happening to labor, and particularly he's not looking at the kind of policies that have suppressed labor. And this, to me, is fairly serious, but it does allow, of course, a lot of room for other people to look at that. But this is a fairly serious issue because he's only interested in the upper percent, basically because of the kind of power they have. But it does seem that there isn't a way of understanding the way that the bottom has at times, like during the Depression and after the Second World War, the way labor and other parts of society have pushed back against the hyper-wealthy in the society. And that can happen and does happen, but that is not discussed here. I think altogether the solution section is not the most important section of the book, but it's an interesting one for discussion for all of us. But I like the book. It's a good read. And if you don't read anything else, read the first chapter. You'll get the whole sense of it.
So, and I banked on the fact that everyone else would tell you what's in the book, which they did. And so now I'm not going to do that. I'm going to try and sort of take a step back, which I can only really do because everyone else has done the hard work for me. And there. And I wanted to open with a quote that I'm going to come back to that hopefully many of you will have heard, though I'm betting that many of you will have only heard one fragment of it. And that is a quote from John Maynard Keynes, where he says in 1924, in the long run, we are all dead. How many people have heard that quote? Like a lot of people, right? In the long run, we all did. The full quote goes something to the effect, this is from memory, in the long run, we are all dead. Economists do very little for us if they tell us that after the storm, the ocean will be calm again. That's how the whole quote goes, though he says it way cooler than I did. But I want you to keep that in your head because it's going to kind of come back. And I won't have to repeat it then. So from what you've already heard, you know that Piketty's argument is basically, I would say, what I call an or-else argument. Via R is greater than G, this cumulative force over time, capitalism is producing a level of inequality that, in his words, this is a quote, is very unlikely to be accepted. Fix it or else. That's the message that the book gives us. Now, I want to focus on this specifically. If R is greater than G means capitalism, or even, I would say, civilization as a whole, according to Piketty, is at risk, then what exactly is it at risk of? What is the or else? And who is the unaccepting whoever out there? It turns out, of course, no surprise to most of you, I'm sure, maybe to nobody, that this problem has a very long history, and I believe it's really important to put Piketty in some historical context, and that's what I'm going to do, and that's why I have this cool art. Because neither his questions nor his answers are novel. I think this history provides the best way to understand why a 700-page economics book, 950 in French, I might mention, is a. That's because when we say not, they say ne pas, so it takes way longer. A 700-page economics book is a bestseller and the hottest topic on the blogosphere worldwide, at least in English and often in French and Spanish too. That kind of thing just doesn't happen because you have a good argument or you're a good writer. So, let's begin. This is, many of you will know this from high school, I hope. This is William Hogarth's Gin Lane from 1751. In the early stages of what we would now call the capitalist era. The etching may be familiar, as I said. I remember learning of it in high school when I was told, I have no idea if this is true, that in this era, poor parents would often nurse their children on gin because it was cheaper than milk. Now, I have no idea, as I said, if that's true. But Hogarth's anxiety suffuses this piece, I would say. There's, of course, condescension here, but there's a lot of anxiety. This is the modern world. This is what modern society is producing, this world. And that, the production part of this, is a crucial idea to what I want to say here. This is not the world that modern urban commercial society is erasing. This is the one it's making. This is new. Civil society, that's the term that was used at the time, and still used today by many, the private realm of the economy, public life outside the state, this is producing a social disaster for many. You can feel the dread in this, from this terrible development, I would say. No, did that work?
Yeah.
Okay. Many of you will have heard of this guy too, Adam Smith. Two decades later, after Hogarth, he publishes The Wealth of Nations, 1776, blah, blah, blah. Smith, of course, also had a theory of civil society, but one that's far more optimistic, as many of you will know, based, as all theories always are, and this is going to be really important to my point, though it's obvious, based, as all theories always are, in the world in which he lived. He was witness to an extraordinary explosion in commerce and in the emergence of new non-state realms of economic activity. He saw the modern world of private enterprise as tending to produce more and more wealth and more opportunity. I should mention, I have chosen these, I am no art scholar, that may be obvious already, but I have chosen these pieces because I think they kind of communicate the feeling that I get from reading these works. So these aren't endorsements of this work. If there's something bad about some of these, you can just ignore it for now. Thanks, Clint. So Smith didn't use the word, but capitalist markets come out of his account looking pretty good. He described a smooth circular flow of goods and money between landlords, producers, and workers that was basically a virtuous circle. There are some things that markets don't do well, he said, like supplying armies or building bridges, but in general, there are a few seeds of destruction in modern economic development. Now, in these two images, we have, in oversimplified form, certainly, two ideas of what capitalism and market-organized society can do and where they lead, or where it leads, to Gin Lane or to a businessman's paradise. These two theories continue to struggle for our hearts and minds, and many people, I think, have them struggling within them all the time, every day. Others, of course, thought Hogarth was right, but saw a lot of light at the end of that tunnel. Perhaps the most famous of these others, and I think often the most misunderstood, is Marx himself. Marx, of course, had a theory of civil society as well, based in the thought of others, but developed for the world around him, a world of increasingly intense exploitative industrialization. Millions of men, women, and children working all day, every day, for almost nothing, living in squalor and with no prospect of escape, no means to make a living without continuing to sell their bodies to capitalists for a daily wage. Now, Marx argued that capital's monopoly over the means of production, in combination with market competition, crucial, produced two tendencies. First, toward increasing dispossession and exploitation of non-capitalist elements in the economy, including labor, and second, toward the reduction of profits. At some point, and it is not at all clear when, and Marx, of course, never claimed to know when, the social bonds holding the system together will no longer hold. Marx argued that a similar emerging tension between the needs of society and the way it organized its economy had led to the end of every other mode of production, and it would seem quite reasonable to expect the same would be true of capitalism. Of course, he was not so disappointed at this prospect. He saw capitalism's seeds of destruction as also seeds of a new era. In fact, he once wrote to Engels during the financial panic of 1857, the long-forgotten financial panic of 1857, saying that he liked to visit the stock market these days because it was one of the few things that made him bounce with joy. He really used the word bounce. I mean, the German version of it, which I don't know, but that was the translation I read. Anyway, so let's bounce forward a few decades in this, which is the fastest history of ever of economics, to John Maynard Keynes, who was born the same year Karl Marx died, 1883. Now, one might say that at the broadest level, Keynes' understanding of market-based civil society combined elements of Smith's and Marx's. Like Smith, Keynes saw markets and private property-based civil society as the motor of production of wealth and as the best possible means by which to realize economic progress. But he also saw the flaws inherent in the capitalist system if left to self-regulate. Like his forebears, Keynes' thinking was completely shaped by the world around him. In this case, interwar Europe and England. He understood that world, which seemed to him and many others like one continuous disaster, as a logical outcome of half a century of high liberalism, free trade, privatization, unregulated markets, a system often called laissez-faire, which most of you probably know what it means, but just in case you don't, it basically means let civil society do as it will. Keynes said this freedom might have enriched some, but it had left many behind and then killed itself. World War I, the rise of fascisms during the strife of the 1920s, then the Depression and the emergence of Nazism, these were all the products of laissez-faire, market-organized, in Keynes's terms, individualistic capitalism. Now, capitalism might be good at producing wealth, he said, but it was not good at distributing it, nor was it good at dealing with uncertainty. And uncertainty was inescapable and only made the distributional questions harder to solve. When people are feeling uncertain, they tend to hoard, or at least not to invest and consume, a process that, of course, starts a vicious cycle with which we are very familiar. Investment was the biggest problem of all. Uncertainty about the future means that we can never guarantee an adequate or steady flow of investment, and investment is what produces employment. If it slows or stops, so too does the flow of available opportunities and income. Keynes believed that the world around him taught him very clearly where mass impoverishment, joblessness, and inequality led to fascism, Stalinism, and war. This is where the world leads in this situation. As Keynes saw it, this inevitable trajectory on which laissez-faire runs and the roller coaster it put modern economies on was only avoidable if it was managed, he said, and only the state has the capacity to do that. And in contrast to what many think of when they think of Keynesianism, which is usually like the welfare state and fiscal policy or whatever, Keynes actually, in the book, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money, says that the best way to do this is to use monetary policy to encourage employment-based investment. The problem, however, and this is where we get to Piketty, the problem, however, was that the interest rate, according to Keynes, the return to buying debt, which confusingly Keynes calls R, which screws everything up, the interest rate was often higher than what Keynes called the marginal efficiency of capital, which is to say the profit rate an entrepreneur could hope to make or expect to make by a productive investment in things that would actually give people jobs. If the interest rate that anyone with money can get from buying bonds or sitting on deposits beats the return you can get from investing in stuff that employs people, then they're going to do that, but we're also then therefore going to find ourselves on precisely the road of self-destruction to which high liberalism had led, a creaking rent-dependent aristocracy and international aggression. This is what Keynes saw as the product of liberalism in its purest form. In other words, Keynes says that the problem is the inequality, R is greater than our MEC, marginal efficiency of capital, and it is better to be a renter than an entrepreneur, unless the state steps in. Since the state cannot guarantee a certain return on productive investment, the one thing it can do is keep the interest rate low, so productive investment looks like the better option. If so, then capitalist animal spirits, which is a famous term he used, I love that, animal spirits will be very sprightly and investment will flow. Keynes' most famous work, where he lays this theory out, is called, as I said, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money. It appeared in 1936 and was greeted with a very familiar level of debate, celebration, and derision. Piketty would be familiar with this feeling. Now, at this point, you won't be surprised to hear me say that Piketty has essentially written what I think is a general theory for our times. The inequality R is greater than G tells us that, barring the exceptional period after World War II, it is almost always better to be a renter than an entrepreneur. But this is not good for capitalism's legitimacy. The difference between R is greater than the marginal efficiency of capital, Keynes, and R is greater than G, Piketty, is largely a product of history. In Keynes's day, with the smell of aristocracy still in the air, the distinction between productive and unproductive parts of the economy was pretty much taken for granted. In fact, Keynes called R unearned income. Not a term we hear much these days. Now we call it capital gains. Piketty collapses marginal efficiency of capital into his R because the distinction between rent and income from productive investment has become a lot blurrier in our financialized era, an era in which vast pools of mobile international capital flow toward the highest yield, regardless of its source or its means of producing it. When a manufacturing corporation, this is a standard story, when a manufacturing corporation like Ford uses its profits to invest in debt-backed securities to increase the dividends it pays to hedge fund managers who then return those profits to their investors, it's very difficult to tell where the line between rent and legitimate real profit lies. Ultimately, as Piketty shows, this blurrier R also tends to beat the returns to growth. And that, in the end, is a big problem, because it accelerates inequality, and thus, literally, if you read the book, and those of you who will have read this, hopefully will agree, the idea is that literally it puts civilization at risk. At risk, I think, from precisely those same things that Keynes was afraid of: violence, disorder, fascism. Literally, those are the specters behind this book. Like Keynes, Piketty thinks that we can do very little to alter G, the rate of growth, and the best we can do, just like Keynes said, is to lower R. But since he feels we cannot divide capital any longer into a good productive investment and bad parasitic rentier categories, tax is the mode. Messing with the rate of interest won't work anymore. And after 6 years of rates near zero and skyrocketing profits and inequality, clearly he has a point. The only way to effectively lower R is a global tax on capital, which Marjorie covered in great detail, which is great. If we refuse to take something like this on, the world is headed in a dark direction, Piketty says. So, like Keynes, Piketty's great or else is drawn from the world around him, increasingly unequal, increasingly undemocratic, and increasingly precarious. It is plagued with political and economic fragmentation. Decades of geopolitical order seem to be coming unstuck. We have right-wing populisms in supposedly faithful parts of the liberal core of the world, France, for example. And then all of this is backed by environmental and atmospheric decay. Anxiety and trepidation are widespread, and Piketty makes a lot of sense in that world. And this world is anxious in the same way that the world was when Keynes published The General Theory in 1936. So for Piketty and Keynes, it doesn't matter a whit if pure liberalism is truer or morally superior to other principles of social organization. Those questions are moot if it renders the very foundations of social order unstable. If free market utopianism makes any sense at all, Piketty and Keynes say, it is only in the long run, and in the long run, we, those of us who have to go to work tomorrow, are all dead. As Keynes himself said 1 year later in 1937, to clarify this, we do not know what the future will bring, except that it will be quite different from anything we could predict. I have said in another context that it is a disadvantage of the long run that in the long run we are all dead. But I could equally well have said that it is a great advantage of the short run that in the short run we are all alive. History and life are made up of short runs. If we are at peace in the short run, that is something. The best we can do is put off disaster. If only in the hope, which is not necessarily a remote one, that something will turn up. This, I believe, is the reason we're all here tonight. This is why this book matters right now, because this is why people so desperately seek to know that there is a reason, there is something that can be done. And part of the problem, of course, is what Piketty and Keynes both tell us, is that we don't have to do much. A tax on capital, it doesn't take a lot. We can tweak this system and it'll work for everybody. But the bigger question doesn't get addressed, which is, can with a little bit of fiscal ballast, can we right this capitalist ship? Neither of them ask that question, and that's because that's a much scarier question to ask, but that's the one we also need to be asking at the same time. Thank you very much.
I'll be back in a month with fresh interviews. Until then.